Calling the meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Today is Thursday, April 13th, and the time is now 10:15 a.m. We are joined by Representative Carrick, Representative McKay, myself, Representative Rauscher, who is chair, and in the room, I do not see any other legislators to note at this time. I would like to thank the House Records Secretary, Jordan Wright, and the LIO Monitor, Lisa Denny, for the MI Committee aid, of course, Craig Valdez, for all the work they do for this committee. At the time, we are now joined by Representative Wright and Representative Shragi. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everybody to silence your cell phones, any other personal electronic devices that you may have. So, if any of the audience needs to pass a note to the committee members, they could do through the committee aid. Craig Valdez, we're joined now by Representative Brox, and he could take care of it during any presentations. I just want to say this ahead of time. If you would each wait till the end of a slide before you can ask questions, if the presenters will wait in between slides in case there is a question, that would be nice. All testifiers will direct comments through the chair, and those asking questions do likewise. We have two items today on the agenda. First, we'll hear House Bill 154, an act relating to subsidiary corporations of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and establishing Alaska Energy Independence Fund by the request of the governor. Secondly, we will be hearing a presentation from Alaska Renewables regarding up-and-coming wind power projects in Alaska. Following the introduction of the bill by AHFC and AEA, I plan to ask the will of the committee in adopting a committee substitute and plan to hold the bill until Tuesday, April 18th, at which time we will hear a public testimony and work through any proposed amendments. I'm also giving you notice that I'm setting an amendment deadline for Monday, April 17th at 4 p.m. for that bill. All right, so let's get started. I'd like to call Brian Butcher, Executive Director of AHFC, and Curtis Thayer, Executive Director of AEA, and Kias, and this is the part I always trip over, Gilopsis, did I pronounce it correct? I apologize every time, and I don't mean to do that. Deputy Executive Director for AHFC, I will note for my fellow committee members that we are having available telephonically to answer questions if needed the following. Jimmy Ord, Director, Research and Rural Development, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. James Wheel of, he's the Director of Budget Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And Michael Strand, Chief Financial Officer and Finance Director of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Gentlemen, if you'd like to start, please place your names and affiliations on the record, and you may begin. Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee members before they begin? All right, please begin, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Brian Butcher, CEO, Executive Director of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. I have with me Ike Gilopsis, our Deputy Executive Director, as well as Curtis Thayer, the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. I'd like to move forward on the PowerPoint past our photos to slide three, where we'll talk a little bit about what we'll discuss today, the policy objectives of the bill, the role of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, historically in energy, the role of Alaska Energy Authority, and then we'll give you a brief overview of the specifics of the bill.
Please continue.
On to slide four, policy objectives. This does basically two main things. It has AHFC establish a subsidiary corporation that would be set up in a way that would allow us to pursue federal dollars for energy-related issues. It could be energy generation, could be renewable energy, could be energy efficiency, a number of different areas, and it also establishes the Alaska Energy Independence Fund, AEIF, that I'll refer to as the fund, that allows us to have capital to match with federal, to match with private sector capital, to potentially do projects, and we'll dig a little bit more into what we're thinking of in there a little bit later, to benefit some of the energy needs of Alaska that we see that we're falling short given the tools we have to try to tackle some of these issues. A little bit about the relationship between the HFC and AEA. It goes back decades. Our two agencies have been the two agencies that receive state energy program funds by the U.S. Department of Energy. For a number of years, AHFC was the state energy office, and we worked with AEA. In the last 10 years, AEA has been the state energy office working with us. We split the funds 50-50. We're more focused on the energy efficiency side of things. They're more on the energy generation, as well as some energy efficiency. So I just wanted the committee to know that there's been a long-term relationship between our two agencies. We work together on a week-to-week basis. There's a lot of overlap in some of the things that we do. And so this is just the next natural step of some of the work that our two agencies have been doing together. Slide five, the fund would help spur energy innovation consistent with the governor's administration objectives. And you're probably aware in the last month or so, we've seen two administrative orders come from the governor, 340 that sets up an Office of Energy Innovation and 344 that sets up the Alaska Energy Security Task Force, which is a task force that will be getting going here pretty quick. And so the purpose of the fund would allow us to draw federal funds and private capital, as I had said, to begin to tackle some of the issues that we see in Alaska.
Anybody? Good. Please continue.
Okay. Slide six. The fund can help Alaska be competitive for historic federal funding opportunities. In the short term, the U.S. EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has a greenhouse gas reduction fund grant opportunity that we can pursue. There's a pool of $27 billion. $7 billion has been set aside for states, communities, tribal entities, a number of other groups. But the larger pool, $20 billion, has been set up for nonprofits, something similar to the subsidiary we're looking at setting up here, and have the availability to work. In all likelihood, we would be working with nonprofits in the state. We potentially could be working with government entities in the state. And it's a real opportunity to tackle a lot of challenges that we see in energy efficiency and in energy production that we may not, the way we're currently structured, have an opportunity to pursue. And the reason I'm kind of talking very conceptually is we don't know the details of this yet. Now, the expectation for these funds is that we'll get guidance sometime in the summer, potentially in the fall of this year. Congress has instructed the EPA to administer and get the funds out by September of 2024. So there's a real immediacy to the setting up of this subsidiary because we're going to know here a few months after the legislative session ends what we need to do and how we might be able to apply for these funds. And so the sooner we're able to begin putting the subsidiary together, the easier and more likely it'll be that Alaska will receive a piece of this of these funds.
So the basic framework, the ground rules, is what we're setting up with this piece of legislation.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. We're forming a subsidiary and structuring it through, we would do it through regulations, through AHFC, very broadly, so we would have the flexibility as time went on to be able to put more kind of flesh to the bone.
Tone it down. All right. Thank you.
Other areas that we may see a benefit from here is waivers through the Department of Energy for loan guarantees that if funded through a state energy finance institute, which is what we're talking about setting up, and potentially stacking different capital stack with time-limited energy tax credits. And that's where there's real opportunity in this state where there may be energy projects that we're not able to do because they don't pencil with just private sector dollars. But if we're able to bring in federal dollars, we're able to use dollars from this fund, we're able to use tax credits, we may be able to set up projects that do pencil and can actually be constructed when now we can't without this tool.
Please continue.
All right, slide seven, policy objectives of establishing the fund are to help Alaskans be less dependent on expensive energy sources for their homes and businesses. Alaska is one of, if not the most expensive place to be dealing with energy needs, and certainly they vary across the state. Southeast Alaska with electricity and hydro is different than South Central Alaska with natural gas. Fuel oil, we see coal, wood. It really depends on what area of the state you're talking about. But we really see a large variety of different fuel sources. The one constant being it's, compared to the lower 48, very expensive. Our small population, how spread out we are some of the limitations, as well as the harsh winters, obviously, that we get that the majority of the country outside of the northern Midwest doesn't have to deal with, really makes the burden on Alaskans much larger than I think you see in most other states. And this will allow us to be competitive for once-in-a-generation federal funding opportunities, which the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Act is the opportunity we're referencing there. But in talks with folks in D.C., they do expect there to be other opportunities for funds to come down the road. And they're not likely to be as large as we might be seeing right now. But I really do believe that if we do set this up, there's going to be opportunities down the road because we already have this that we might not normally have if we didn't have it. And we look forward to those opportunities as well. Slide eight emphasizes the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's long track record of managing innovative programs. The photo on the top was Governor Palin signing the bill that gave $300 million to the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation for energy efficiency programs and for the home energy rebate program. And if you were here in this state about 15 years ago, you probably either were able to take advantage of the home energy rebate program or at least probably had an energy rater come in to see if your home needed some energy upgrades. And they were phenomenally successful programs. We ended up administering over $700 million over a 10-year period of time. The great advantage of the home energy rebate program is that Alaskans, to use the program, needed to have their own skin in the game. You would get an energy rater, and the rater would tell you what you needed to do to make your home more energy efficient. You would then do that, and then in an 18-month period of time, submit your receipts to AHFC, as well as the rater coming back in on the back end to say how much more energy efficient you made your home, and then you qualified for a rebate. So even though the state played a role in certainly motivating Alaskans to use the program, Alaskans also had to put their own dollars in as well to make their homes more energy efficient. And we've seen over the both programs an average of over 30% reduction in energy use. So this is something that didn't just benefit Alaskans 1 year. It's benefiting Alaskans today, 15 years later, as a result of dollars not spent on energy or dollars that Alaskans can use in other areas, and was of great benefit to the state.
Please continue.
Okay, slide nine. I'll touch on this just briefly. We have a number of other, and they're really too long to list, but we have another. These are some of the primary energy efficiency programs that we have at Alaska Housing. We have an energy efficiency interest rate reduction. So if you have a highly energy efficient home, you get an interest rate reduction when you come to Alaska Housing for a mortgage. We also have what's become a lot more popular in the last probably 10 years as home prices and values have soared. People have been looking more at renovating the homes they're in rather than potentially trying to look at coming up with the dollars for increasingly more expensive homes. And so this allows for improvement that increases the home's value. Any renovation you would want to do on your home would qualify, but energy efficiency has been a big piece of that. And so in the last few years, you can see at the bottom, AHFC has financed over 300 renovation loans for just under $100 million for Alaskans.
Please.
Slide 10 focuses on the weatherization program. The corporation administers anywhere from $5 million a year and higher. It's a mix of state funds paid through HFC's dividend to the state, as well as federal funds that come in. And so with the huge needs in the state, that small number has been allowing us to more chip away at the issue rather than be able to do something on a larger scale. But we continue to operate that program. We also manage a number of programs that allow for modeling your home to be more energy efficient, an energy rating system that the energy raters use to come in and rate how energy efficient your home is and give you a list of things you can do to make it more energy efficient. We provide the training and certification for all the home energy raters in the state. We also adopt and update the state energy code and a building code for Alaska Housing. By state law, we can't purchase a mortgage unless it's an energy efficient home. So the more energy efficient homes there are, it not only benefits the homeowner in terms of lower energy costs, but it benefits them in being able to qualify for Alaska Housing loans that most other areas wouldn't be able to get, lower interest rates, basically. Slide 11, some of the unique challenges we see in the state that we have been able to, the corporation's been able to step up and help. We have a tradition of working with our sister agencies and organizations to help meet the needs of Alaskans. Most recently, we were able to help DOT out in western Alaska after the storm to try to make sure FEMA dollars were spent responsibly on housing. DOT was the lead, but they certainly didn't have the expertise in housing. And that's just one of many examples of some of the partnerships that we've had with our sister agencies to the benefit of Alaskans. We've been able to stand up programs that Alaskans in need have been able to have needed. A good example that I've already discussed is the Home Energy Rebate Program. We've also, during the pandemic, administered emergency rent relief and homeowner mortgage relief through the federal pandemic bills. And we've administered almost $400 million in those programs, as well as federal homeless dollars that have come in. And it's something we've been able to add in addition to our normal activities without having to increase the number of employees that the corporation has working on these programs. And one thing we've done, which has been unique to Alaska Housing that plays well with this bill, is we have stepped up and created subsidiaries for a number of different needs that the state has had. The Alaska Corporation for Affordable Housing, the development of affordable housing is our most recent subsidiary. We also developed the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, AGDC. It's its own independent corporation now, but it started out as a subsidiary of HFC. The Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation, we sold tobacco bonds 20-some years ago to fund state capital projects for the state. And there's been a couple of others. So we've been able to step up in a number of different areas that was needed. The abilities and the expertise of the corporation has come in handy in other areas other than just housing. And just in summary, we've had decades of experience working on many of these programs. Our experience with AEA over the decades has been considerable. And so we look forward to an opportunity to develop the subsidiary in concert with our friends in Alaska Energy Authority in a way that's able to take care and help potentially areas of energy that we haven't previously been able to accomplished through the agencies that we're currently set up to run. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Curtis to take the next couple of slides focusing on AEA's aspect of this.
Mr. Thayer, would you mind putting your name on the record? Before you begin, let's go ahead and fill
you in. Thank you. Curtis Thayer, the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. As I presented before to this committee, AEA's mission is not only to reduce the cost of energy, but also we need to look at resilience, reliability, and redundancy in our power systems. We do that through six different areas within AEA. We are the owner of Bradley Lake, the largest hydro project, and we own the majority of the transmission lines between Homer and Fairbanks. Our ownership of that line saves the Fairbanks community $35 million a year in cost because they can buy power cheaper in Cook Inlet and shipping it north. We also operate the Power Cost Equalization Program, which provides a subsidy through an endowment for rural Alaska, so they have the same energy cost for the first 750 kilowatts as the rail belt enjoys. The cost of that program is about $40 million this year. And with that, also, we have rural energy, where we construct bulk fuel tank farms and diesel powerhouses in 197 communities in rural Alaska. And then really where we key in on this particular legislation is the renewable energy and energy efficiency. We have a team that looks at the different alternative energies, whether it be biomass, hydro, solar, wind, and we have working groups in addition to working with individual communities on those needs and what would be best fit for community needs. We also have grants and loans. We have the Renewable Energy Fund, which is a fund that was started in the legislature in 2008. It has the legislature has appropriated over $300 million. And what that does is looks at projects for feasibility and proof of concept and then takes them to design and construction. And we have over 100 active projects. But where this particular program and this legislation will particularly help us is we have these communities that have a proof of concept. They have a viable project, but it is the state that over the years have not had the funding to help move it along, or it's a too small a project for the federal government to be involved or through any of their loan programs. But it needs capital to do that. And the Independence Fund here would allow for I would say, missing segment that we have to be funded to move them to the next stage. We also have the Power Project Fund, where we work with utilities and independent power producers on their projects. But by statute, we are limited to a degree of how much we're capped in certain areas. This fund will help fill that gap when there is a gap over what we can do to what this new fund through Alaska Housing is able to do. And then we do energy planning, which is the economics and engineering. And so our role in this bill, is to help with the technical assistance. And we've had the long time relationship with Alaska Housing on this. And so this is really just a natural extension of actually being able to programs that we've started and move forward where they can get that capital move forward to those next steps, which we've needed for a very long time. And with that, the next slide, and you've seen this slide before, and we are, by the way, we are getting numbers for each one of those, but those are, in a given year, those are the communities we're active in. And so when you have legislation like this and people looking at a green bank, for it, we already have people in the field and in Anchorage here working with all those communities. So we have firsthand knowledge on a lot of these projects that will be funded and need to be funded. And so that's where our technical assistance comes in. And so we're very supportive of the bill. And again, we were supportive of the bill last year as we are this year because there's just a definite gap. And knowing that the funding is there coming through through the federal government, now is the time to move so we can be staged and ready. So thank you.
Good. So I assume Mr. Gail Absence, you up next, if you would, put your name on the record, and you can begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ike Gilopsis, and I'm with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. With the committee's indulgence, Mr. Chairman, our final slides are giving a cursory overview of the mechanics of House Bill 154. And with your indulgence, we will briefly summarize what those do. As Mr. Butcher alluded to at the beginning of this presentation, Mr. Chairman, House Bill 54 and its companion in the other body proposed to do essentially two prongs to obtaining the policy objective that was outlined earlier. The first is expanding the powers within the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's statutory authority toolkit by enabling it to create subsidiary corporations that can be nonprofit subsidiaries with a specific purpose of achieving sustainable energy development projects. The secondary prong would be the creation of a fund that is heretofore named the Alaska Energy Independence Fund. And the intent would be for the parent corporation to transfer management of that fund to the nonprofit subsidiary with the explicit purpose of doing twofold portions of a mission. The first is in being able to marshal capital from federal and other sources, and secondarily to work in a collaborative environment in Alaska's energy ecosystem, both with our for-profit community and our lending institutions, but also with our other stakeholder groups to try to achieve, as Mr. Butcher has alluded to, the type of capital stack that would help clear the hurdle for energy projects. If there's no question at this time, Mr. Chairman, on this slide, I'd respectfully proceed to the next one. And what is on slide 16 for the benefit of the committee and the public, Mr. Chairman, is a proposed implementation process. And this is in reference to what Mr. Butcher had mentioned with respect to the timetable that has been set due to the federal funding guidelines. In order for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to be competitive for several of these funding opportunities, it would need to be able to establish a subsidiary corporation. That takes, of course, legislation that would need to be enacted through the legislature and agreed to by the administration. But once it becomes effective, the process then kicks off through the board of directors at the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, where the board, the executive management teams, and external counsel, as well as the Department of Law, work to create the necessary proposed bylaws for configuring that new subsidiary to make sure that it achieves two very key objectives. The first is that the subsidiary corporation would purport to do the policy mission that is embedded in House Bill 154, create sustainable energy projects. But secondarily, the board would want to ensure that that nonprofit subsidiary does not have recourse to the parent organization. And there's two reasons for that. The first is for showing fidelity with federal funding authorities that this nonprofit subsidiary corporation is a bona fide subsidiary, that it wouldn't be a shell corporation. It has true bylaws, it would have a board, it would be able to set itself up to regulation. It would be a transparent arm's length process from the mission of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. But secondarily, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation is mandated by statute to provide affordable housing opportunities to Alaskans and to do so through the bonding process. And so how that corporate structure is created is done just as much to protect the nonprofit subsidiary as it would be done to protect the parent organization, the mortgages that it underwrites for Alaskans, and the bonds that it issues that are subject to the external rating authorities, primarily in New York. The other part of that sequence, Mr. Chairman, is once a subsidiary is constituted and the bylaws have been established, then the process would begin of collaborating more earnestly in a formal way. This would assume an informal relationship heretofore between both the Energy Authority and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation in understanding the aperture of the type of staffing needs that would populate that subsidiary in the immediate portion after its creation. And what we mean by that, Mr. Chairman, is that if the objective is to anticipate the forthcoming guidance from the EPA and the other federal authorities by the spring, summer, and fall of this calendar year, the type of staffing needs would likely be geared more towards any type of application aggregation process, working with stakeholders to make sure that the application the state of Alaska would put forward through the subsidiary would be robust, would show fidelity to the congressional intent as well as the federal guidance, and make Alaska be competitively positioned to be able to capture those dollars. Finally, Mr. Chairman, the sequence would be, in the event of successful accumulation of those capital dollars through all these sources, the appraisal of that endowment will lead to the next development, which is what type of program could be created as a result of that stack. If the subsidiary was successful in being able to get a certain amount of dollars in one scenario, there's a certain stack of programs that could be deployed. If it were incredibly successful in getting several orders of magnitude more funding, that greatly changes the scope of what kind of projects could be enabled. And so that is the proposed sequence, Mr. Chairman, and what would occur in the event of this legislation being successful. With that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes, I believe, unless Mr. Butcher and Mr. Thayer have anything to say, the initial overview of the legislation and the policy objectives. We're happy to briefly conduct a sectional analysis if necessary and answer any questions that the committee would want.
So, yeah, if you want to go ahead through the sectional, that'd be fine. And then I have a question. Well, actually, I have some background information that I'd like to have everybody know. Do you have a question before the sectional? Sure.
Yeah, through the chair. Thank you, Chair Rauscher. Just a quick clarification. If you could back up one slide, Mr. Gialopsis, I thought that you had said that the Energy Independent Fund would have its own board, but I believe here it says that it would have its own bylaws and initial regulations, but not its own board. Can you clarify which is correct for me? Thank you.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Shragi, this is Brian Butcher. It would have its own board set up. The way our subsidiaries have been set up, including our nonprofit subsidiaries, the board of the corporation is the board of the subsidiary, but they're set up separately and their decision-making process is separate.
Through the chair, thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Shragi. Representative Carrick, you had a question?
I can wait till after the sectional, actually.
Okay. Gentlemen, whoever wants to present the sectional as it is, please. Continue.
Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, Ike Gilopsis with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And for the committee's edification, I understand that there is the entertainment of a possible committee substitute. That committee substitute, as I understand and the corporation has reviewed, is conforming to the legislative drafting manual. And so there were no substantive changes that occurred as a result of that drafting configuration. And I raise that for the committee to say that as this sectional analysis is conducted, where there were changes that were identified, the corporation would be pleased to put that on for the record in anticipating that potential consideration.
I'm glad you clarified that. I was going to ask. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. To commence the sectional analysis for the committee and the public, the first section of the bill would add a subsection, and that would be under findings and purposes for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. This would be essentially the reason for existence for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And that can be found in Alaska Statute 1856.010. And that creates a new subsection, hotel, some lowercase h. And it clarifies that the corporation has a purpose to create subsidiary corporations that can assist in financing sustainable energy development in Alaska. And that that project is actually a public purpose. The second section of the bill, Mr. Chairman, would amend the corporation statutes by allowing the creation of subsidiaries. That specific power is listed in 1856-086-alpha. And the only change that occurs there is simply adding the terms for sustainable energy development in terms of the reason for why a subsidiary could be created. The third section of the bill, Mr. Chairman, would amend the corporation's general powers and limitations. This is the remit for the public's benefit of what the corporation can do. It's also the answer to the question that members of the public may have as to, from a technical perspective, why Mr. Thayer is at the table, because it explicitly lists that both the corporation, that is the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and the Alaska Energy Authority would be allowed to work together to both support and establish certain entities, i.e. a nonprofit subsidiary, that can provide that type of financial and technical assistance to them. So this is the explicit merging of the energy technical assistance that the Energy Authority purports, as well as the financial technical assistance that the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation would have. And, Mr. Chairman, this is the first change in the CS that the members of the committee may see. That can be found on page 3, line 19. The first line there, after the word municipalities, legislative legal determined to add the words "that is" simply to clarify the purview of assisting municipalities. That has no substantive change on the bill. Okay. Section 4 of the bill, Mr. Chairman, is going to have a miniature sectional analysis because each of the subsection components have some unique provisions. And so with the committee's indulgence, I'll proceed to Section 4 Alpha. And this is the proposed creation of the Alaska Energy Independence Fund. This would create a new sub-article within the AHFC statutes, a new proposed Article 6, and that fits within the general provisions on energy efficiency and conservation programs. If members of the public were going through basis and looking at where this fits within the actual glossary of the corporation's body of laws. And so that new proposed section constitutes the fund And it allows the fund to consist of federal grants, unrestricted loan payments, and other types of income. And the other types of income would be interests on loans. An important distinction here between what's online as the current version, Mr. Chairman, and what might be the proposed CS is that a portion of the language from subsection alpha for drafting purposes was lifted and then relocated into its own subsection. So it was not stricken from the bill. We will see that as we go further through the sectional. Moving on to proposed section 4, Bravo, Mr. Chairman. This would propose for the committee's edification how money and assets in the fund would be used. And it simply allows for the general provisions that other types of subsidiaries of the corporation have had. In other words, it empowers the subsidiary to work on generating loans to finance sustainable energy development in Alaska. It allows for the securitization of bonds by a nonprofit subsidiary. And so that's where you're seeing the explicit fusion of the language between the earlier sections in the bill that allows for the creation of a nonprofit subsidiary and explicitly showing how this one would be managed by such a nonprofit subsidiary as well. And it also, Mr. Chairman, allows monies from the fund to pay for the administration costs of it. And this is in keeping with general guidelines that the state of Alaska and other state chartered corporations have done. They use the proceeds of those funds to be able to pay for the costs of administering it. Moving on, Mr. Chairman, to Section 4, Subsection Charlie. This is a subsection that would list the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation as a fiduciary of the fund. Now, for the benefit of the public, a fiduciary is a standard that we have in state statute that requires a high degree of ethical responsibility in managing funds. And then there is allowing also within that subsection a deviation from the prudent investor rule. And Mr. Chairman, what that means in layman's terms is that a prudent investor rule in most financial institutional parlance is a requirement of a fiduciary to manage funds as if they were their own. And this is meant to prevent what would be perceived as unnecessary, risky propositions. The reason why that language is necessary for a nonprofit subsidiary to manage the fund is that though a for-profit entity may be very, for lack of a better term, conservative in the type of loan aggregation programs, many of these sustainable development programs are on paper comparatively riskier. And that would naturally exclude them from the ability to be considered for financing. But if a public purpose entity is specifically looking to try to lower the hurdle rate for those, it would be able to do so if it had a waiver from the prudent investor rule. And the reason being that the rationale for creating that organization, the rationale for accepting the funds and deploying it, are very clear and transparent to the public. And so that's why you see this belt and suspenders language here to ensure that this is not encouraging reckless types of programmatic development for financing mechanisms, but rather to say we recognize that sustainable energy development projects are comparatively more financially unconventional, and they simply require more unconventional means by which the federal funding authorities have made clear as well, Mr. Chairman. And finally, language also in subsection 4, Charlie, clarifies that the money that would be appropriated to the fund would be managed by the corporation through a nonprofit subsidiary. So if a fund were to be having receipts or deposits, they would not go, as Mr. Butcher has said, to some other subsidiary or go into the Housing Development Fund. It would specifically go to the proposed Alaska Energy Independence Fund. Mr. Chairman, the next subsections of Section 4 are rather rapid, and so I will try to maintain a more accelerated cadence with your indulgence. The new subsection Delta has language that allows the corporation to establish rates and securitization parameters, and that is the language that is currently in the subsection Alpha that I mentioned earlier that will now be part due to the drafting change as its new own subsection Delta. Subsection Echo, Mr. Chairman, allows the corporation through its
Representative Prox has a question.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, going back to subsection C, deviate from the prudent investor rule, B, because we have determined that it serves a public purpose. The public purpose is ambiguous, I guess is the right word. And how then are we supposed to evaluate whether this is a higher public purpose than education or transportation or healthcare or any of those things, or any of the other projects that might be under consideration?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Prox, I would respectfully direct the committee's attention to Section 1 of the bill. And that is an important question that you raise, Representative Prox, as to what constitutes a public purpose. And as is seen in the proposed Section 1, subsection hotel, the findings that are being proposed are to say that creating a nonprofit subsidiary that pursues sustainable development projects would be a public purpose. And so that proposal, if it were to be endorsed by the policymakers of this chamber and the other body and ratified by the governor, would be the lodestar by which the parent corporation would create the necessary bylaws to be able to weigh those type of applications as they were to go through. And I would defer to Mr. Butcher if I missed something at any part of that.
If I could add to that, Mr. Chairman, this is Brian Butcher. At the end of the process is as the corporation, the subsidiary, went through that decision-making process, we will be coming back to you on an annual basis. We will be able to list to you the funding sources we've been able to access, the projects we've been able to move forward on. And so there is kind of a checks and balances a little bit of the process. And it would be our expectation that the projects we would go into ultimately, I think you would all agree to. But if there was something that you felt uncomfortable about or wanted to know a little bit more about, we would be available to you at any time to go through those discussions.
I'm just trying to learn more about how this is evaluated. In the corporation is going to spend federal dollars ultimately that were designated for a specific purpose. So we can't really compare this to spending money on education because we can't do that. But within the bounds of what this corporation will be authorized to do, where would we go to start looking for comparing one project to another so that we can understand this a little better?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, the limitation on this subsidiary would be to the funds available to that subsidiary, which would be very focused on a federal basis. Is a good example. If we are to get access to the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, it would be very much limited by the federal government on what we could do with those dollars. It's not something that would be fungible into education or anything else. It would be focused specifically in the area for which the subsidiary was created.
Representative,
That's about as far as I can go.
You're fine.
Thank you.
Representative Shragi?
Thank you, Chair Mauser. Yes, through the chair. So following up on Representative Prox's question about the prudent investor rule, is there any reason that we couldn't maintain our adherence to the prudent investor rule but just put sideboards up on the types of investments that can be made? Why would that potentially be problematic for this fund? My understanding is that the prudent investor rule essentially says go for the projects or proposals with the best return. So why not say let's go for the ones with the best return, but within these specific parameters so that we ensure that we are investing in good projects that will provide a return in the long run and allow this fund itself to be sustainable as opposed to potentially veering into more riskier portfolios that could in the long run undermine that underlying investment.
Through the chair, Representative Shragi, and after I speak, if either of my friends up here have something to add, please do. It would certainly be my intention that we would always follow the prudent investor rule, if at all possible. I think the flexibility this gives is there may be certain circumstances. And when I think about some of the potential projects out there, I think about a lot of what AEA and others did 20 or 30 years ago with wind farms, certain areas that did not pencil. And when we stack a lot of different capital to a project, it potentially could be a project that could be described as not following the prudent investor rule, but there may be a federal incentive through the dollars that would lead us down that road. So I feel like it may limit, and again, this is all conceptual, it may limit the potential, in particular rural Alaska. The cost is a lot higher. And it would be my concern is that we would be in a circumstance where something could be put together that could be argued maybe didn't follow it, but did follow the intent of the federal dollars and did follow the intent of the purpose of the subsidiary. And that's an area that I think that would fall into. But like I said, we would always, unless there was a really legitimate reason, federal dollars and others follow that prudent investor rule.
Please continue, Mr. Gilopsis.
For the record, Ike Gilopsis with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Mr. Chairman, to resume the sectional analysis, which is nearing its end, I would direct the committee's attention to the proposed section 4 subsection, which would be echo in the new proposed committee substitute delta in the version that's before the committee. And this is existing language that has been allowed in other HFC ventures that allows the corporation to require a deed of trust for certain buildings. And this is a type of collateralization mechanism to help with financing. It's a very standard type of nomenclature. The next proposed subsection, Mr. Chairman, would be subsection Foxtrot. That would be subsection Echo in the version before the committee. And that is the second reference to the Alaska Energy Authority. It would allow HFC, through its subsidiary corporation as well, to contract with the authority. And that contractual agreement would allow technical expertise to be shared as well as assistance when evaluating energy loans. So to both Representative Prock's and Representative Shroggy's questions about the evaluation conception when a development is coming before the subsidiary, that relationship of being able to have not just a financial scoring mechanism, but also a technical feasibility scoring mechanism would be embedded with this framework as well. The next subsection that's proposed, Mr. Chairman, would be the next proposed subsection, Golf. The current version is Foxtrot, and this is a proposed ceiling that the subsidiary would be able to not do more than $20 million in loan guarantees without coming again before the legislature. So again, Mr. Chairman, in reference to previous questions and to what Mr. Butcher has stated, this is an explicit safeguard that if there was to be a deviation of some sorts from the prudent investor rule, there would be an aberration that would require the justification from policymakers to affirm that direction as well if that dollar amount were to exceed that, particularly if we're talking about loan guarantees above the $20 million threshold. The last two subsections of the proposed section for Mr. Chairman are the new proposed section Hotel, the prior Golf, and that requires the corporation when trying to develop these products that would be created through the subsidiary corporation in the fund to consider the state energy policy. And the state energy policy, for the record, Mr. Chairman, is to aspire as a state of by the year 2025, which is admittedly coming up fast upon us, to have half of the electrical generation in this state coming from renewable sources. At present, I believe it's approximately 33%. When that goal was instituted in 2010, it was about 25%. So substantial progress, but still short of that goal as of today's date. And so this is a mandate to consider. But in reference to the prior consideration of a waiver of the prudent investor rule, it's not a mandate to, at all costs, do something that might not be cost-effective to simply hit that mark. Finally, Mr. Chairman, in subsection 4, that's the new proposed section, India, prior section Hotel, and that simply directs the parent corporation, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, to manage the Alaska Energy Independence Fund by the regulations that the corporation would adopt. And that's what Mr. Butcher has referenced. I do apologize, Mr. Chairman, I was in error. There is a final subsection due to the CS, a subsection 4J, that clarifies, as is pro forma with any establishment of funds, that nothing in this bill would purport to create a dedicated fund and be aberrant to the state constitution. The very final section of the bill, Mr. Chairman, is section 5, and that would amend the corporation's general provisions. For the public, that's the portion within the corporate statutory structure that has definitions. And this would add definitions under Alaska Statute 1856-900 to add a new paragraph. That paragraph would be numbered 3, and that would create a definition for sustainable energy development. And that is meant to hew to a lot of the language that has been seen in the congressional record for the type of fuel sources and projects that would qualify for some of these Environmental Protection Agency and Department of Energy funding. Mr. Chairman, that concludes the proposed sectional analysis, and we thank the committee for its indulgence.
I appreciate it very much. Now, just for some transparency, we have Representative McKay, Representative Shragi, and Representative Prox here who may have heard a similar bill last session. And I believe the main difference between that bill and this bill is that one went through ADA, and now this one is going through the Alaska Housing. So just for those who have a question on why it may or may not be familiar to you, I just wanted to point that out as a matter of transparency, because I believe it ran out of time, ran into kind of a hard spot with ADA, so it was rewritten to go through Alaska Housing if anybody had a question there. So I'm just putting that out there right now. And if I'm wrong, these gentlemen here could correct me. But are there any more questions? Carrick, Representative Carrick, can your question.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you for the thorough presentation and for bringing this legislation forward. Something that I think I'm really excited to hopefully see happen. I am curious, though, as we talk about these incredible once-in-a-generation opportunities to leverage federal funding dollars, do we expect in the long-term future of having this fund to continue to receive large numbers of federal funding dollars, or is there a point at which we expect or at least hope that private investment will start to fill in and take the place of some of the gaps we may experience post, these current funding opportunities?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick. Yeah, we do anticipate the establishment of a green bank kind of opens the door to a lot of different processes for the state. But if you look at green banks that have been successful in other states, they have seen 6-to-1 private-public dollar match, 8-to-1 in different states, depending on how successful they were. Now, I would probably guess that our comparison would be a little lower than that, because those are high-population states with a lot of corporations and probably a lot more opportunities than we do. But it would absolutely be my belief down the road that we would see a greater than 1-to-1 private sector dollar, public sector dollar, as projects were set up and benefits were seen for being involved in this project.
Thank you, through the chair. And how many states currently have some type of green bank structure, like what's proposed here, if we know? And then a second question there is, are any of the initial fund capitalizations in other models partially capitalized with private dollars, or is it very typical for a state to put forward their own investment in that fund capitalization?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, just under half of the states have green banks, although a number of them are under consideration, like we are here in Alaska, probably for the same reasons we are here in Alaska. That I'm aware, and I'm not the expert on all of this, we can certainly look into it and get back to the committee. The majority that I have seen, if not all of them, had public capital starting out. In fact, Connecticut Green Bank, which is the probably the oldest and most successful of the green banks, I had a meeting with the executive director of Connecticut Green Bank 6 or 7 years ago in discussing this with the state. They actually have a piece of tax that Connecticut residents pay, a very small percentage of, that goes into this green bank. So they actually have funds dedicated to the green bank with public funds. But I believe they all began with public funds and were able to expand from there.
Great. Thank you. You good? Representative Prox, then Representative Shragi.
Yes, thank you. I guess to keep harping on the point, this is a once-in-the-generation opportunity. And the next generation is going to be paying for it. They're not going to be happy. Is there an expectation that this subsidiary will continue somehow after these federal funds are no longer available?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, it's really determined by the necessity. If we see the projects being successful, I mean, the way I think about this is the subsidiary is either going to be tremendously successful or successful on a smaller scale, but I think it'll be successful nonetheless. And in terms of AHFC, we have had subsidiaries like the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation that have been successful enough that we've actually spun it out into its own agency through legislation, and it wasn't a subsidiary. We also have a subsidiary right now, the Alaska Housing Capital Corporation, that was formed to have funds available for capital projects that potentially has been defunct. And there have been conversations about potentially eliminating that subsidiary. And about that time, the finance committees find a use for it, and it kind of revives it. So we're constantly looking at our subsidiaries as a reason to either turn it into something else if it's successful or look at eliminating it. And so I would absolutely give you my word that if we were 5 years down the road and it really didn't seem to do anything that we think it will do, which would be unlikely, that we would look at eliminating the subsidiary.
Representative Schrage.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher, and through the chair. So can you help me get a better picture for the kinds of projects we're discussing? You know, we've heard a lot in the presentation about AHFC projects that are currently active or have been done in the past. Can you give me a better idea as to, I mean, are we financing rooftop solar on commercial buildings? Are we financing hydroelectric plants? Are we what are we doing? And I know it's early, the fund hasn't been created, but certainly I'm sure there's been some thought put towards, if this is successful, what some of those initial programs might be. Can you give me some sense of that?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Schrage, I'll explain a little bit on how we've seen it work from the housing side. And then I'll look to my folks up here to give you more details on that. We have an ability to work on affordable housing projects through our nonprofit subsidiary that we created, the Alaska Corporation for Affordable Housing, that really was set up somewhat similar to this, where it was able to take tax credits, federal tax credits, private dollars, for-profit developers, some of the corporation's funds, the subsidiary corporation's funds. We've had other contributors such as the Rasmussen Foundation that have come forward and all come together to be able to produce housing units for seniors and for affordable housing units for families that are being built right now in the Fairbanks area. We previously had quite a few units built in Anchorage, that it really took having the ability of that subsidiary to bring all those different sources in. So when I think about it broadly, I see that as being somewhat similar to what you'd be able to do with an energy project that probably doesn't pencil without being able to pull all of these together. But I'll look at Curtis or Ike for details on potentially what that might be.
For the record, Curtis Thayer, Executive Director for Alaska Energy Authority. Through the chair, Representative Schrage. From my experience with the loan programs that AEA operates, we're probably looking at the ones, projects. Well, we have a loan program that limits the size by megawatt or the type of projects that we have. And this fills in that next step, that next gap. And so I would say that you would see this in small hydro projects, solar and wind turbines. An example is AEA has successfully, we have lent money to the Houston wind farm. We've also lent it to the Willow wind farm. And with that, but we've reached a cap on what our program allows for, and they're still looking at other opportunities to grow and increase those renewable opportunities. And this fund would allow for that. It would help for that funding when they've exhausted what we can provide. Now they can go to a different fund and have that same, or go there or start there from the very beginning. So it really is going to, I think, add to what's available. And just for something earlier, is of the fund of the renewable projects that we have funded, our delinquency rate is zero. Some of them are considered high risk by normal circumstances, but as we've managed the fund and worked with patient capital, we've had no defaults. And so there has been a success in renewables and funding them that maybe a traditional bank or something would not look at or did not look at in the past. But now they are, you know, they've held their own, so to speak, and are producing very well.
Follow up, if I may.
Follow up.
So, and then through the chair. So in, and I've got version 0154A here. I believe that's prior to the committee substitute coming out. But right. In section 4, subsection G, it talks about prioritizing sustainable energy development for residential buildings, commercial buildings, and community facilities. Is that an ordered list? Or first we go to residential, or those are just generally the kinds of projects that we're prioritizing with the fund?
For the record, Ike Gilopsis with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Mr. Chairman, Representative Schrage, that language is not meant to be sequential, but meant to be inclusive. And so this language will hopefully showcase the universe of potentialities that both the federal funding was envisioning, but also the aperture by which the subsidiary once created, working with what capitalization it would have, would be able to inform those type of programs. As Mr. Butcher alluded to earlier, the size of the eventual endowment will determine not just the length and lifetime of that subsidiary based on what it can spin off in terms of development loan projects, as Representative Prox asked, but also the scope of them as well. And a perfect example to that is the U.S. Department of Energy is allowing what is called the Title 17 Innovation Waiver. And what that essentially is, under current federal law, if a community or a private sector developer would like to pursue a lower emissions project, but it is not a uniquely novel or innovative technology, that project is not eligible for any federal loan guarantees, which has a retardant effect on being able to attract private capital. However, if there is a state energy financial institution or institute, pardon me, that would be constituted by doing this type of configuration, there is what's called now, as a result of recent congressional legislation, a Title 17 waiver. So going back to that hypothetical scenario, if there was a solar or wind farm or a small-scale hydro project, which have now been in existence in some cases decades, in hydro's case over a century, that waiver allows that private capital to partner with a public institution like the subsidiary to be able to get those federal loan guarantees, get a much more competitive capital stack of both private and public capital, and actually deploy a renewable technology source for the benefit of the businesses, the residents, and the community. And that just kind of shows the breadth of the ecosystem due to the lack of specificity heretofore of the federal funding agencies. That is where a lot of this is going to be determined, and we completely appreciate the wish for more clarity, as we would in that anticipation. But that is the honest answer of being able to say why the parameters proposed in this legislation are meant to be somewhat firm but broad.
Very helpful. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. Representative Carrick, did you have a question? And then I just want everybody to know that's going to be the last question. We have to move on because we have a presentation. And I assume that these gentlemen could be available to talk to in your offices today. And I assume that they're going to be available either online by Teams or in the building on Tuesday. So, we do have to get through some stuff. But please ask your question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, just a brief question. So we talked a little bit just now about the types of, well, I guess my question is more about, the types of entities that the Green Bank would ultimately work with. So is the anticipation to have a mix of individual residential homeowners participating in loan programs as well as utilities? And can you just add a little bit more context in terms of, we've talked a lot about the funding sources, but in terms of actually working with entities, what types of entities are we working with would the bank be working directly with?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, it really depends on a lot. We anticipate there'll be larger scale projects There's a lot of nonprofits that work in the renewable energy area, similar to the ones we work with in housing, that participate and are part of projects that want to see things move forward but can't do it on their own. I would see that as an aspect of it. I would see different federal programs, not just the ones we've talked about that we're looking at pursuing the short term, but some others that look towards moving that forward. So I think there's a big scale aspect to that. But there's also looking at potential programs for individual homeowners, which is something that we've done similarly. And the example I gave was the Home Energy Rebate Program that had such a tremendous benefit to homeowners in reducing their energy costs. Ultimately, we had to wind down the program because of lack of funding. This may be an opportunity to get that going again, although I do have to also add that the federal government is providing the state approximately $35 million for something very similar to a home energy rebate program. So it's going to give us opportunity to do things on both a larger community scale and a smaller individual homeowner scale, depending on our access to the funds and the interest we're able to find with the banks, the private sector, and potentially those larger nonprofits.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carrick, and thank you, gentlemen, for coming today and presenting this bill to us. At this moment, we're going to let you guys go, and we're going to hopefully have a motion here to adopt the CS. Just out of transparency, when a committee substitute is there, it's because our legal team rewrites it in a language that we can utilize. It has already been spoken to by Mr. Gialopsis that they have already previewed the intended CS, and they feel that it falls in the parameters of what they're trying to put forward here in this in with this bill. So I'm going to entertain a motion at this moment.
Thank you, Chair Rauscher. This is Representative McKay. I move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill number 154, version Bravo, also referred to as 33-GH1074/B.
Hearing no objection, the committee substitute to HB 154 is adopted. And we'll take a brief recess while we change seats here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Back on record, and now to the second item on the agenda. Wind-powered projects in active development by Matt Perkins, CEO, and Andrew McDonald, Vice President of Alaska Renewables. I believe Mr. Perkins is with us on Teams, and Mr. McDonald is here with us in the room today. Mr. McDonald, if you would place your name and affiliation on the record, you may begin.
Thank you, Chair Rauscher. My name is Andrew McDonald, and I'm the Vice President of Alaska Renewables, a Fairbanks-based renewable energy development firm focused on harnessing the power of renewable energy to deploy real projects in Alaska at scales that can reduce our reliance and exposure to gas and liquid fuel prices, and deliver a reliable, cost-reducing energy supply for Alaska. I'm a 10-year resident of Fairbanks, and I moved to Alaska at that time to work at the university as faculty there. In the time since then, I've worked at the university for 10 years, but now I moved to the private sector, and I've spent that last decade learning about the challenges and opportunities for energy in Alaska, and in particular in the interior. And so my understanding and my interest is based really in the community-centered problem-solving, bringing real solutions to the table that utilities and other entities in the state can act upon in order to ensure a reliable and supply and cost-effective supply of energy. So Matt and I formed the company about 2 years ago, and we've been focused on really identifying the technological and project solutions that can deliver on this goal. So we're really about, we're not looking for, we're not taking a tool and applying it to a problem. We're really starting with the problem statement that the utilities here in Alaska have, and bringing the best technological solutions to the table. So that means we've surveyed and we're open to all technologies. We've come to focus the last 2 years on wind technology as the first and most important addition to the grid that we think can make a real difference relative to today's existing energy supply. Matt and I are both engineers by training, chemical engineering myself, Matt, materials science, and so we take a real engineering-based approach to this problem, and working with the utilities and the technical experts in all subject matter areas to identify the real ways in which we can deploy these projects effectively and reliably on the grid. We're also very committed to collaboration, and we've been working closely with all of the rail belt utilities over the last 2 years to identify these opportunities and put them in front of them so that they can act to diversify their energy supply, especially at this time when the energy supply in Cook Inlet is uncertain, and we need to diversify to protect consumers against the coming increase in costs that we would otherwise see without that diversification. Here's a figure of the natural gas production in Cook Inlet. And over the last 2 decades, the production has declined substantially. And this is driven in part by the nature of the depleted basin, but also the economics of new gas development in the Cook Inlet region. And so getting access to the new resources is becoming more and more expensive and difficult. And so that's driving a potential, what DNR says could be a imbalance between the supply of gas that we have in Cook Inlet and the demands that we have from the electric utility sector and heating sector. By 2027, that imbalance could start playing out. And so we're really looking to deliver solutions on those timescales that can provide an answer to some of the energy challenges facing the state. Similarly, in Interior, where I'm from, there's Golden Valley Electric Association is looking to procure additional megawatt hours of clean energy and or gas energy from down south. And so as they look to retire the largest coal plant in the state, the Healy 2 project, in the coming years. So in February, the rail belt utilities were all here in this building briefing the Senate on this upcoming gas shortage in Cook Inlet and the problem that needs to be solved in order to establish to ensure cost effective energy is provided to Alaska's customers, residents, and industries for the years ahead. And so we really have an opportunity here in the next 5 years to deploy wind energy in particular at scales that can provide answers to this challenge. And so just speaking theoretically, we could add in on this time frame with external capital from the private sector, we could deploy 400 megawatts of wind capacity by 2028, and that could displace up to 8 billion cubic feet, or 33% of the natural gas demand provided to the electric utility sector in the Cook Inlet region. These could be deployed on short, predictable time development timescales by 2028, and these would protect consumers from rising costs of energy that might otherwise be incurred by importing LNG or making large investments in bringing in gas from elsewhere. To be clear, this could be part of an overall energy system that is a blend of diversified supply of oil, natural gas, and renewables such as hydro, wind, and solar.
Representative Prox, you have a question.
Yes, thank you. I understand yours is a private company.
That's correct.
Just working with utilities and et cetera. And you're competing with Delta Wind as a wind farm project and other options for bringing energy into the interior.
That's correct. Yet we plan to reply to any forthcoming renewable requests for proposals for renewable energy projects. Golden Valley has decided to issue an RFP for such projects by their strategic generation directive. And so if that opportunity comes, then we will apply to that opportunity, yes.
And I know 400 megawatts of wind capacity. Are you planning on building a wind farm of that output? 400 megawatts?
Alaska Renewables is developing a portfolio of projects across the rail belt, and I can get into that in the next slides and give you some more detail on the actual project specifics. We're focusing on two large wind projects, one outside of Fairbanks and one on outside of the Beluga power plant near Cook Inlet. And those are the first two projects that would be up to 10 times larger than the largest wind power plants currently in Alaska. And so they are of the scale that could deliver this volume of energy to the grid. Yes.
Through the chair, Representative, follow up.
Through the chair, sorry, yes. Are we going to get to the total cost of this at some point? Your presentation?
Cost information is obviously through the chair, sorry, Representative Prax. Cost information is obviously confidential, but we expect that these projects will stand on their own economic feet to be cost competitive with today's generation resources on the grid.
Well, then follow up.
Representative?
Not even a rough order of magnitude of. Well, maybe it doesn't make any difference to us if you're not going to be spending state money.
Through the chair,
do you plan to spend state money?
Through the chair, we have applied for a renewable energy fund grant, and AEA has recommended us for a grant through that program this year. We have not yet accepted any state money through that program. Golden Valley Electric Association has applied for renewable energy funds in the past, and they've deployed wind resource assessment resources on the Shovel Creek site that we're developing outside of Fairbanks. And so this is all accretive to our goal of bringing on these projects to the grid, but to speak directly to when we build the projects, we do not expect to utilize any state money for that, and we will bring in outside capital to fund these projects, and that will be possible by establishing power purchase agreements with the utilities and that will enable the financing of the projects from outside capital.
So, Mr. McDonald, Matt Perkins is showing us his video. I thought maybe he might want to have something to add here.
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Great. Hey, great work, Andrew, and great questions. Through the chair, I'll just add, because the representative asked for order of magnitude, that the current cost of generation in South Central is $60 to $80 a megawatt hour. And in the interior is $120 to $140 a megawatt hour. And across the portfolio that Andrew's about to present to representative, that should give you an order of magnitude of where the projects will come in. So that is to say, no adverse impact on rates, but rather a stabilization of rates through eliminating volatility in the form of liquid fuels or natural gas.
Representative Proxy has a follow-up question through the chair, right?
Through the chair, yes, through the chair. What I'm interested in is that there are other alternatives to wind power, and one being gas from the slope. And why I was interested in the magnitude of the upfront cost, if you will, is if this is substantially lower than bringing a gas line down from the North Slope, then it's really not competing. We're talking about something that might be doable, whereas the other one is just too high of an initial cost. But I was interested in competing alternatives to wind. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. McDowell, will you continue with your presentation?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Rauscher. So, through the chair to Mr. Representative Prax, the reason why we've selected wind energy as our initial focus of technology deployment is primarily due to the low cost of power that it can provide to the grid. Wind energy is a proven, mature technology that has been deployed at over 800 gigawatts of scale globally. And especially over the last decade, there's been dramatic improvements in the efficiency and reliability and scale of the equipment and technology that's being deployed. And so it's something that's been replicated time and time and time again as 13 gigawatts of wind energy is installed every year in the lower 48. That's enough to supply about 10 Alaska's worth of energy new energy every year. Secondly, this is a financeable product and project that we can go. And in fact, there's capital is looking to be deployed for predictable projects and contracts like this, where we can set up a 25-year fixed or slightly escalating power purchase agreement. And it's like an annuity relative to stocks. It's a fixed investment upfront that's well known. And because of the wind resource assessment that we're doing on the sites, the energy yield and therefore the revenue from the project is very well constrained. And so we can bring in outside capital to deploy hundreds of millions of dollars to build projects here in Alaska in the near term. Additionally, this technology has a known and near-term development cycle. So the processes that wind energy goes through to get a project up and running are well established and repeated time and time again, especially in the lower 48. And we're bringing that expertise and that development process here to Alaska by developing real projects that can be deployed in the near term. I'm an earth scientist by training, and so studying the resource available to us here in Alaska was really the basis of where we got started on addressing this problem. And so we've surveyed the wind resources available across the state and identified a number of projects that offer the opportunity to provide energy to the grid at a competitive cost of power with today's existing resources. One thing that I particularly like about renewable wind power is that it matches really well with Alaska's winter peak loads. And so we have a lot of energy demand in the wintertime, and that is also the time of year when wind energy is putting out its highest output. And so in the winter, we can see capacity factors of 60-70% in those months. And that matches really well with Alaska's needs that time of year when it's cold and dark. And finally, it's really about energy security and diversity. And so as the state looks at the energy challenges that it's facing right now, wind has the opportunity to factor into that in a really important way over the coming, even in the coming 3 to 5 years. So when we look at the evolution of the technology over the last decade, even when Eva Creek, the wind farm was deployed at Eva Creek outside Healy with 2011 technology, those were 2 megawatt machines and had an 80 meter hub height with a rotor swept area of about 1.2 football fields. The technology that we're looking to utilize today would double or even triple the windswept area of energy that we're collecting from. And so that dramatically increases the efficiency of the energy capture from these units. And as a result, that will drive down, that is part of what is driving down the cost of wind energy over the last decade relative to the technologies that we deployed over a decade ago. And so when we look at this, this is borne out in the actual data. This is the efficiency or capacity factor of the average wind projects that are deployed in the United States over the last 2 decades or so. And you can see a steady march from an average capacity factor of 29% in 2011 up to an average of about 41% over in 2019. And so this means just more energy coming from a single wind turbine, which translates into better project and energy economics. In addition to the efficiencies, the cost of wind energy, and this is an example of turbine prices over the last decade, have been declining by almost cut in half. And so you'll see from back in 2009 era, turbine prices alone around $2,000 per kilowatt of installed capacity. And now we're around $1,000 per kilowatt for the turbines alone. This doesn't account for the balance of plant, which includes like the roads and transmission lines that are required and to connect up a project to the grid. But this gives you an overall indication, combined with those efficiencies that we just talked about what's driving, what's behind the declining cost of wind energy and why it makes sense now for Alaska to deploy these resources at scales that we haven't done before. So my company, Alaska Renewables, is in the trenches, so to speak, of wind energy development. And so we're focused, laser focused, on getting these real projects up and running and deploying them by 2026. And so this involves a wide variety of activities by Matt, myself, and an excellent team of outside contractors, many of which are Alaska-based, almost all of which are Alaska-based. And we're working together to put together all of these different work areas so that we have a complete project ready to go by the end of 2024, or so that we can begin construction in 2025 and complete it for commercial operation by 2026. This begins with market assessment, assessing whether or not wind energy or other technologies are the right fit for the energy landscape here, working up on land agreements with DNR and lease agreements process we've been involved with for the last 2 years on our primary sites, deploying wind resource assessment tools to measure and quantify the availability of the resource, going through engineering studies to optimize the layout of the wind farms and identify the right turbine technology for these sites, and working with the turbine vendors, these large companies like GE or Vestas that produce gigawatts of wind energy turbines every year, to identify the right cost and product fit for these conditions. We're ramping up environmental studies on our primary two sites and have engaged the permitting process that we hope to complete by the fall of 2024. And working closely with all of the rail utilities to explore the possibility for power purchase agreements that would bring this power to their grid at prices that are at or below their avoided cost of energy from existing resources. These projects don't happen in a vacuum. They require the approval and consent of the communities that they impact and that they benefit. And so we've been, as a Fairbanks-based community, we've been engaged with the community up there and are engaging across the state in areas that our projects will impact. We're bringing in outside financing from the big banks and power producers and renewable power producers across the country, and identifying the best construction teams and operation teams that can make these projects a success in the long run, 30-year life cycle of a power plant like these. The two primary, yes,
sure. Representative Carrick has a question.
Thank you, and I just have
through the to, chair.
Through the chair. I just have to start by saying thank you to Andrew and Matt as well for being here. It's not often I get a Fairbanks constituent coming to Juneau, much less presenting in a committee. But I was curious on the is the idea with the power purchase agreements on that last slide to sell power from the Shovel Creek project, for example, to GVA for distribution to homeowners, or is Alaska Renewables at all in the business currently of selling directly to homeowners or businesses?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, we are the scale of these projects is that they are well suited for sales directly to a large off-taker like a utility. And so our primary goal is to sell power to Golden Valley Electric Association and all the other utilities across the grid. We applied for Chugach Electric's power request for proposals for new renewable energy projects over a year ago, and our project at Little Mount Susitna was selected as the project that the wind project that they are pursuing to study, and we are engaging on the feasibility studies for that now and hope to begin power purchase agreement negotiations later this summer. But in concept, we are connecting these projects connecting these projects to the rail belt transmission backbone. And so energy from the projects could be sold to any major utility off-taker on the rail belt electrical grid. And so a project outside of Fairbanks could sell energy to Golden Valley Electric Association and or any of the utilities across the rail belt grid. And we think that it's that diversification of supply from multiple wind farms that could be of benefit in bringing power to each one of these utilities and see opportunities in collaborating on that procurement amongst the utilities as we move forward.
Great.
Representative McKay has a question.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, thank you, Mr. McDonald, for really an informative presentation. And I really like the idea, the concept. It all makes a lot of sense, except I can't quite figure out, if I go back to the slide with the orange and the green graph, you know. So we have all these windmills. There's like 62 of them, I think, listed on one of the projects.
For one project,
62,
yes.
Yeah, which is quite a few of them. Mm-hmm. The wind stops blowing. Something's got to fill that gap. And I think in other presentations, it's usually the answer has usually been batteries that would store the energy and would take care of the load in the grid until the wind starts blowing again, I guess. So how do we get over that? Maybe it's just a misconception or a paradigm that I have wrong, but how do we reassure everyone that when the wind's not blowing, we're still going to have all the power we need from something?
Representative McKay, yeah, Representative McKay, through the chair, that's an excellent question, and one we are in detailed studies with and collaboration with all of the utilities across the rail belt to make sure that the projects, once we bring them online, do not have any reliability impacts on the system, and that we can meet demand, the utilities can meet demand at all times, regardless of whether or not one or any of the projects are producing energy or not. And so the short answer is that the rail belt electrical grid has the gas and fossil fuel generation capacity available to back up variations in the wind and to respond and follow to that variability. It will likely involve and benefit from the addition of battery energy storage technologies, as you mentioned, that can help smooth over some of that short-term variability in particular. As you see a drop off in the wind, for example, you can utilize batteries initially, but then fire up a new gas power plant, another gas power plant, to bring on that reserve capacity to meet the demand at all times of the year.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
And basically, I guess you're aiding reliability, not becoming the reliability. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Chair Rauscher. We think that the diversity of supply,
right,
of resources that we can bring to the grid will, in general, improve the reliability of the overall system.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair.
Thank you.
This is an interesting project. Thank you for at least taking it on. And the other slide indicated that you might be able to be online by 2028?
The first two projects, actually 2026.
Okay.
And so, very short time from now.
Yeah, and follow up?
Oh,
are you the chair? Yeah. Are you through the chair? you're not supplying the batteries on your project. That's somebody else. If those are needed, that's somebody else's going to be supplying those, and they're going to be online at roughly the same time?
Through the chair, there are battery energy storage projects in the works through the utilities right now, and they do plan to deploy a certain capacity of battery projects in the coming year or two that are separate from the projects that we're considering, but of benefit to the general grid stability that will be helpful, and flexibility that will be helpful in integrating a variable resource like wind energy. However, to my point earlier in the slides, we are technology agnostic, and so we're really about identifying the problems that come out of these engineering studies and finding the best tools in the engineering toolbox,
mm-hmm,
to apply and utilize really commercially ready deployments of equipment and technology that can answer some of these ancillary questions around the integration of renewable energy. So we are certainly willing and able to provide battery energy storage or other energy storage technologies to the grid in the years ahead.
Okay. Paul?
Follow up, Representative.
Through the chair. Have you done a project risk analysis for external things like these batteries? Somebody's going to have to build the road to get from here to there. Somebody's going to have to build the transmission line. Is that all factored into your project analysis?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, yes. We are deeply involved in all of those details, and this is an active development on multiple projects. And so engaged in all of those types of things. Maybe it would help if I provide a little bit of actual meat on the potato here. Okay. and tell you about the projects and where we are at in the actual development.
And I just want to add that we're not critiquing any project whatsoever. We're just we're showcasing different aspects of renewable energy in the state when we invite testimony like this here. Just so I thought I'd get that out there.
And I appreciate that. And my concern is we're looking at one-off projects. And at our level, we need to look at the overall system and how it fits into our participation in energy future for the state. And that's where I'm trying to get to.
I understand. Please continue, Mr. McDonald.
Chair Rauscher, yes, and Representative Prox. As an Alaska-based company, we're here to support Alaska's energy landscape, and we're here for the long haul and bringing solutions in support of the utilities and residents and industries that are here. And so, yeah, we look forward to the opportunity to engage, and I'm happy to follow up with you on these long-term type visions and how we all fit and how this all fits into that story. The first two projects that we're focusing on are the Shovel Creek Wind Project outside of Fairbanks and the Little Mount Susitna Project to the west of Anchorage across Cook Inlet near the Beluga Power Generation Project, gas generation plant on the other side of Cook Inlet. The Shovel Creek Project outside of Fairbanks is it's 2.5 to 10 miles west of Murphy Dome. On these ridge systems that are next to the Minto Flats area, and this is a visual simulation of what the project might look like if constructed, or a portion of the project at least. On the left, you can see the Murphy Dome Extension Road there, and this is this project has room for anywhere from 60 to 211 megawatts of wind generation capacity, and would involve anywhere from 18 to 62 wind turbines up in this area. To give you a quick overview on the Little Mount Susitna project, this is a broad elevated plateau to the west of Sleeping Lady, the recognizable profile of Mount Susitna that you would maybe be familiar with in the Anchorage area. This is to the west of that, or 40 miles west-northwest of Anchorage. Access to the project would be via barge landing in the Beluga area and utilize existing oil and gas roads up to the plateau with a extension of the road up from there. And it would connect up to the existing transmission line that used to move a lot of power from the Beluga power plant into the Anchorage area. And this project has capacity for 204 to 280 megawatts of wind generation capacity. In each of these cases, the exact sizing of the project is determined upon how much power the off-taker or the utilities would like to procure. And so we are stand ready to provide for the needs of the electric utilities on the grid. To give you a little bit more detail onto what this actually involves, here's an engineering map and design of our current project iteration. The project would be located here up on the plateau, and the little points are potential wind turbine sites, and the yellow line, a small turbine access road that would allow us to transport the turbines to the site and erect them with a large crane. The red lines show two alternative road alignments extensions that we are considering that would branch off the existing purple oil and gas roads in the Beluga River area unit. And we are the green area is a lease area that is currently under evaluation by DNR for a long-term lease for wind energy production at this site. We're working closely with the DNR office on that process, as well as the easements that would be required for the road and the new transmission extension to the existing gray transmission line transmission system that connects up over into Anchorage and underwater across Cook Inlet. We have wind resource assessment with meteorological towers and LIDAR units that really help us quantify the availability of resource and understand exactly how much energy the project will produce and what time of year, and understand how that will go into the system. We have preliminary engineering design and independent analyses being conducted by our partners in the industry, and we're working with turbine suppliers to identify the best and most suitable turbines for this particular site based on the wind regime and transportation considerations. Importantly, we're working with communities and indigenous groups. For example, we were out in Tyonek, which is a community just on the southern edge of this map. We were out there last week learning about their energy issues and needs for deploying additional renewable energy onto the grid. And so this is a project that we're aiming for commercial operation by 2026, along with the other project, the Shovel Creek project up near Fairbanks. So both are at similar stages of what we consider mid-stage development, with intended construction to begin in 2025.
We have six more slides to get through, and then we can entertain all questions for those that want to stay. I will be back in a minute. Representative McKay has the gavel. Please continue.
Okay, so no questions, right?
Please continue,
Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Representative McKay. I just wanted to talk real quickly about what we're thinking about when we are trying to solve the problem of how to get wind energy onto the system. When we look at wind energy on a project basis, the cost of energy from a project really declines the bigger you make the project. And this is typical for any infrastructure project. If we're going to build an extension of a road and an extension of a transmission line, it'd be nice if that investment was paid off over much more energy being produced from the project over the long term. And so that can drive this economy of scale can really drive down the cost of energy as we start considering these medium to larger size wind farms that have been deployed repeatedly in the lower 48, but have not yet been deployed at this scale in Alaska. And so it's really identifying where is this overlap, how can we get to project sizes of sufficient scale that it meets the cost of energy criteria to bring low cost energy onto the grid without any additional state support, for example. Just how we can also ensure that there's a diversity of supply coming from potentially multiple projects across the state. Representative McKay, earlier you asked about what happens when the wind isn't blowing. And we're actually studying this right now with the wind monitoring that we have up on our multiple sites. What you see here in green and blue is actual data from our two sites, the Shovel Creek and Little Mount Susitna projects, and modeled wind energy output from the two projects at different days. This is about 2 weeks of time snapshot of in December, in the middle of the winter. And what you see from an individual project, there are times like Fire Island when you know the amount of energy coming from the project is zero. And then there are long periods as well where the amount of project of energy coming from the project is the maximum output that it can produce. And it fluctuates in between those. Similarly, for the different projects, there's similar patterns. But interestingly, and there's a scientific basis, just the spatial diversity of wind regimes across Alaska, when we put multiple projects together, the variability in these multiple different spatially diverse resources actually aids in balancing out that different resource and the generation profiles at different times of the day or week or year. And so it's this diversity of supply through multiple projects that can help aid the low-cost integration of large volumes of wind energy onto the grid, producing what you see in the bottom curve, which is a much relatively subdued profile of wind energy generation that is also, importantly, more predictable on a day-to-day basis from weather predictions. And so the dispatchers in the individual utility operating dispatch rooms can look at the forecast for the coming hours and day and say, oh, we expect wind to be on this day. And so we can dial back our gas generation and save that gas for a later time when the wind isn't blowing. And so all of this together leads for less need for curtailment of wind energy, more economic dispatch, and reduced need for energy storage capacity and investment in battery energy storage technology, for example. And so there are benefits to this diversification, even of the wind energy, just in and of itself. So we're looking at these benefits together that the diversity of multiple projects can provide, and merging that with the economies of scale of a new generation of wind power in Alaska to reduce the cost of energy and diversify our supply to the grid. Just back to this again, you know, like deploying two or three projects across the rail belt is doable by 2028. And so we can make meaningful impacts on our energy diversity and the cost of energy, keeping the cost down for consumers and industry here in Alaska on this near-term timescale. And so in conclusion, it's all about really energy security from our point of view, protecting Alaskans from the rising cost of energy and bringing on that diversity of supply. It's about bringing on new jobs and new economic activity and investment into Alaska. These projects will involve hundreds of construction workers during their construction phase and a dozen or two for the long duration of their operation phase. It's going to attract private sector investment into the state and allow the state to participate in the energy economy of the future. Overall, I'm excited about the opportunity to improve the air quality and overall environment and reduce our contributions to greenhouse gas emissions as well, and just diversify our general energy supply as we look to the future of energy in Alaska. With that, I'd like to thank the chair and the committee, and it seems as though my flight back to Fairbanks has been canceled, as well as because of the volcanic eruption. So if any of you would like to stick around and
have another 8 hours
here. Yeah, so at least until tomorrow morning. So so I'd be happy to continue the conversation. I had the opportunity to meet with Representative Carrick, my representative, this morning, as well as Chair Rauscher. So thank you for your time this morning, but I haven't yet had the opportunity to meet with the rest of the committee, and so I welcome the opportunity to spend a few minutes getting to know you better and answering any additional follow-up questions that you have may have offline.
Well, I see Mr. Perkins on the screen here. Before I get to Representative Shragi's question, I was wondering if he had something to add.
No, only one thing, or two things, I guess. I was regretting that I had to miss this trip due to conflicting travel requirements, but now that Andrew's informed me of his travel problems, maybe I'm not that regretful. The only thing I'd add to Representative Praxis, through the chair, to Representative Praxis' question about hedging your bets. Energy development is about community engagement, but it's also about game theory. And so there's a backup to each of these projects, because projects do suffer. Any project suffers a fatal flaw, you know, as much as we're working hard to avoid that and retire those risks. There's a backup to each of these projects, and there's a backup to the backup as well. So that's the nice thing about the sizing and strategy that Andrew and I and the team have put together, is we are not hanging our hat on a single facility.
Well, thank you very much. Representative Shragi, you had a question for these gentlemen.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher, and through the chairs. So on the slide where you showed the two wind supplies and how they, could offset each other and provide some stability to the grid, I really appreciate this slide, because I was really fortunate to be able to attend Energy Institute this past fall and look at some of the wind production in the state of Washington, and they pulled up an interactive map where you could see not just two wind production sites, but quite literally more than a dozen, and you could see them all toggling on and toggling off, and they were able to manage that flow of electricity throughout the state to meet all the power needs throughout the state of Washington rapidly, I mean within seconds, moving that energy supply to where it needed to go on the grid. We've also heard in this committee, though, that there are constraints with Alaska's transmission infrastructure, specifically a couple of bottlenecks. Do those actively provide any hindrance to you and your company as you look to deploy wind resources in the state? Does our transmission infrastructure currently allow for these projects and allow for that energy to be moved effectively, or are you not constrained until we get beyond these projects and further into renewables?
Through the chair, Representative Shragi, that's an excellent question, and it's a question that needs to be studied in detail and is being studied by our engineering teams and through collaborations with our utility off-taker partners. I would say that, you know, we focused our attention initially on these two first projects that can be deployed with minimal or no upgrades to the existing transmission backbone of the Alaska grid. Definitely the ability to wheel and move power easily from one region to the other does help the economics and expansion of these types of opportunities. And so where we really see the limitation coming into play is more on the scales on the transmission side, is really on the third or fourth or fifth projects that we may look to do in the coming decade. And so the efforts that Alaska is making, and AEA through grant funding and investments by the state as well, and federal dollars, is important to the long-term structure and of the grid and feasibility of integrating renewables at scales larger than this. But we're focused immediately on what we can do here and now to meet the problems of today and meet the energy needs of Alaska as we see them today with these first two projects.
Thank you.
You bet. Representative Brox, I saw your hand.
Yep. Thank you. Through the chair, one of your potential competitors is the state of Alaska. People have been dreaming of Susitna Dam for 40 years. And we've been dreaming of a gas line for 40 years. Maybe those are a little closer now than they were 40 years ago, but
does that, you might have a more attractive option than in particular to sit in a dam, because it's both just electricity. And if you do disperse these wind projects theoretically far enough, then you don't have to worry so much about the transmission lines and all of that. Are you working with someone, and can you provide us some insights? I guess sell your project relative to Susitna Dam.
Through the chair, Representative Prax, we think that wind energy offers, you know, a very competitive economic position to provide large volumes of renewables or energy in general to the grid. But we don't really see it as competitive with these other potential projects, to be honest. You know, even with these two wind farms online at scale, we will still need a large amount of gas resource in order to, you know, provide the balance of power. We hope to bring these projects on at costs that makes it common sense to utilize wind energy when it's available and save the gas for when it's not. And so relative to hydro, as you mentioned, has a very long development time cycle. One thing that we're, and part of the reason why we're focused on wind, is that short development counterpoint to hydro. But should another hydro project be brought online, in general, you know, wind can partner well with hydro in terms of hydro can dispatch to help balance the variability in the renewable energy resource, and you can store that water behind the dam and use it for a later moment. And so in general, when we look at the portfolio of options that Alaska has available to it, it's really about, comes down to the fundamental economics and availability. And so you know, there's solar too as well, and that's also a competitive option. It provides more energy during the summer and not much during the winter. And so, but it's this diversity of supply and really this diversification of our resource base that will allow us to avoid putting all of our eggs in one big basket. And I view any of these projects as potentially complementary and not necessarily competitive. If we get a big gas line from the North Slope down to South Central, you know, and you know, it's probably going to make more sense to try to sell that gas on the open market as LNG than utilize it if we can get cheaper power from wind. And so, you know, like, just monetize that gas in other ways, and so, you know, or utilize it when we need it here during lulls in the generation profile of our mix of renewable assets. So I view this all as complementary resources and part of the diversification of supply that Alaska needs to be well positioned in the future.
All right, well, Mr. Representative McKay, you have a question?
Very quickly, and I know I want to go too, but I want to have, through the chair, I just want to have a little fun with my colleagues. Mr. McDonald, will you be needing a 404 wetlands permit from the Army Corps of Engineers for any of these projects? And secondly, will you be needing to do an environmental impact statement for the EPA for any of these projects? And you can answer that after if you'd like.
Representative McKay, through the chair, yes, we're deeply engaged in the permitting process right now, and we do anticipate that the projects will have some small, minimal wetlands impacts, and that we are looking at alternatives to mitigate. And so we are engaged with the Army Corps to go through the wetlands permitting process. As we, we're working on that process now. And the whole host of environmental permits that we're going to need to get these projects permitted by the end of 2024 and start construction in 2025.
Excellent question, excellent answer. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Mr. McDonald, Mr. Perkins, for your time coming here and presenting this to us. I found it very interesting. I also appreciate the endeavor you guys are undertaking to provide renewables for the state of Alaska. I would like to thank everybody for the meeting today. I do want to remind you, amendments for HB 154 will be due Monday. I'm going to make it noon on Monday. That way we have a chance to look them over before the meeting on Tuesday. Tuesday we will have public hearing on HB 154. The plan is to, at this point in time, to move it out before the end of that meeting. We will be able to question the gentleman that we're here again today, either online or in the room itself. And I also want to remind you that we will have public comment that day. So, and that will be Tuesday as a public comment. Monday is the amendment deadline at noon. And so if there is no more business to discuss, I will adjourn this. There isn't, right? I'll adjourn this meeting at 12:50.